Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is a returning guest. It's James Tate to talk about his book, The Architecture Concept Book. James is an architect, author, and educator. He is a contributing writer to the Architects Journal and a studio tutor at the McIntosh School of Architecture. James, thank you for being back here with me and welcome again to the show.
Thank you very much, Ben. My pleasure.
So, of course, in the last episode, I asked you to tell us a little bit more about yourself, and I'd love to hear if there's anything that has come up since our last talk, but I was hoping to dive right in. And so kind of the first question I want to ask you is, so this idea of a concept book, you know, so anyone who's been in architecture school for a few minutes has probably heard the term concept and probably feels that they're very familiar with it. So the question I have for you is, what led you to write a book about something that in theory, and that's a leading question, that we all should be familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be honest, the genesis of the book really was quite organic. It was also brought about by my circumstance at the time. I mean, the start of the book was really in the middle of the last recession, so pretty much about the end of 2010, and I was out of work. I was living back at my parents' house, and I was also collecting my welfare check, or as you would say, and as we would say, sorry, in the UK, our dole money. And I was really just looking to keep my mind active and thinking about architecture. So I started sketching thoughts and ideas every day, relatively randomly. Eventually, I found work in London, but I felt like I'd started something and I wanted to really keep it going. It was also writing down these thoughts and sketches and ideas was also a really good creative outlet for me at the time, because I was working on projects on site and I wasn't really having to use the right hand side of my brain much. It was all about schedules and details and arguments with contractors. So it was quite a good way, a kind of creative release. And it was basically just sketches on the subway or my lunch break or when I got home from work. And eventually I moved back up to Glasgow, my home city, and I had about 3 or 4 sketchbooks filled with these ideas and thoughts. And I actually always intended them to be private until I went for an interview to become a studio tutor at the McIntosh School of Architecture, where I work now. And I showed them at the interview, and the interviews were, I think, just offhand mentioned that I should get them published. And that kind of set off an idea in my head where I thought, right, yeah, maybe there is something here that I can write and bring it together. Now, I never actually got the job as a studio tutor then, but once the book was published, they gave me a job. So that then developed into, I developed that myself into a book proposal, tried to format it and arrange it and sent it out to probably about 100 different architectural publishers. And I started to get some interest, and eventually I decided to go with Thames and Hudson, who are based in London and New York, and they were really instrumental in taking this, you know, random collection of ideas and thoughts and really helping me develop them into a coherent narrative. Which eventually the coherent narrative the common thread through all of these ideas was the concept, the idea. What is the idea behind your building, and how does that idea become strengthened and realized throughout the development of a project? To be honest, it's quite humbling now talking about it. Thinking that a few private sketches that started while I was out of work and living at my parents' house and the suburbs of Glasgow has now become a worldwide selling book, really, across, being translated into Korean and Chinese and things like that. So, that was essentially the story behind how the book came about.
And so I'd mentioned that the idea of concept should be something any one of us who's gone through architecture school should be familiar with. And so right in the beginning, you do make the case that we're not using the idea of concepts correctly. And of course, I read why, but I'll pretend like I didn't. Could you explain to us why you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think concept, as you rightly say, is a term we're all familiar with. And essentially, it means the central idea behind any project. And I think what the book tries to do is basically explain that must be the key component of creating architecture. Now, I think often as students, and I see this now teaching, we're kind of taught to focus on this idea, the concept above everything else. But I think once that project develops and more detail is added and more things come in, the original idea can sometimes be lost and that energy can sometimes dissipate from a project. And then conversely, as architects working in practice, I think I've got experience of the fact that we can quite easily lose sight of the overriding idea or concept behind what we do. We spend far too much of our time writing emails and churning out typical details and schedules. And I think quite often the central idea of the building can get lost in this process. And I think just a small quote from the book, but I think it's quite important, is that our ways of working can struggle to keep up with our dreams. But sometimes the dreams aren't even there in the first place. So I think this book is really trying to bridge that gap, I suppose, for students, to guide them through the design process and how to maintain the energy and ambition of their original ideas. And also, probably secondarily, I think the book is probably mainly aimed at students, but I think for architects in practice as well, to inspire them to always think about what that central idea behind the project is at every stage of the design process, whether that be a sketch for a master plan, a facade study, or even the detail of a window, to always think about how you are being true to the original concept. And I think just to touch on what you were saying there about the term concept being misused in architecture, it's almost sometimes used disparagingly. We talk about concept architects, basically architects whose fantasies are destined to remain on paper. We talk about conceptual architecture, so basically projects that are deliberately designed to be experimental and provocative, but probably never built. And we talk about the concept stage of the design, and that's actually something that the Royal Institute of British Architects use as terminology for an early stage of the design process, where we have, you know, nominal wall thicknesses, assumed site constraints, and a kind of notional structure. And I think the way we're using it today in architecture is kind of misleading. They suggest that the idea, the concept, and the built reality are actually separate entities. And I don't think that needs to be the case.
So onto the idea of, you know, concepts particularly aimed at students. So of course there are some more literal traditional concepts in here that I do want to ask you about. But one section I came across is some of the more, I guess we'll call them obscure ones, like politics and economy, which are something I don't think anyone has ever tried to sketch, but I can't imagine anything that has more impact on our buildings. So I'd love to hear you elaborate on that in particular a little bit for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think those, of course, the book is about the ideas behind our buildings, but our buildings and our architecture. But you can't realize these ideas if you don't take into account what you quite rightly describe as probably the two most important aspects that affect architecture. Now, economy and politics are what I would probably call specific concepts. So these are concepts that arise from external conditions of the time, in terms of the effect how and what and why you design, along with things like the context, the social context, and more urgent, up-to-date things that affect us all, and affect every single building that is built at a certain time. But on top of that, I think there are also universal concepts, or effectively eternal concepts, that these specific concepts have to be fed into. So universal concepts would be more about the kind of eternal search for beauty through proportion, scale, and form, the honesty of our architecture, how it is constructed, and then light, how architecture harnesses light. And these things are timeless. They can't really be disrupted by things like economy and politics. So you'll see throughout the book, kind of go back and forth between these two types of concepts, between the specific ones like site conditions, economy, politics, and then the universal ones, there's a chapter about wonder, and there's a chapter about scale, there's a chapter about colour, and rhythm and order. So it's just trying to introduce students to the fact that there are things that are current and present and urgent. Most urgent just now is the climate crisis and how we deal with that. But those have to be woven through with the timeless ones, as well, about light and scale and the search for beauty. So, and those needn't be in opposition. I think they just need to be harnessed together to really realise the potential of what as building designers and architects we can can create.
Interesting. And so, of course, there's a lot of concepts in here, and I'd love to go through them all, but we just simply wouldn't have the time. And so, you know, of course, you just did a great job explaining some of the more esoteric ideas. But I guess I'd also like to ask, you know, there are some very literal ones. There is, you know, floor, roof, wall, which I'm sure anyone at first glance may roll their eyes a little bit. And, you know, what can they learn about those ideas? So maybe it's a vague question, but I guess the question I have is, you know, when you present concepts like that, I personally know that you show a lot more in there, but what could you tell us about something that we probably feel like we can't learn about?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I tried to do with those particular aspects, I mean that, so the book is structured into four sections. There's assess, which is effectively about assessing the world around us and trying to understand where architecture's place is within that. There's analyze, where you look at specific modus operandi of architects and also types of architecture. You look at form and function. So we're really trying to analyze what it is that we have been taught as architecture students and what's important about that. And then the third section, which you're alluding to about floor, wall, roof, ceiling, that's entitled Assemble. So, I mean, from the dawn of time till now, all of these elements, floor, wall, door, window, have all been essential to create architecture. And I didn't, there was no point in me treading over old ground. As you say, everyone would roll their eyes and just think, why is this guy saying things that someone else has already said in a better way a few hundred years ago, or maybe even a few thousand years ago? So what I tried to do with each of these sections was to take a kind of left field view of them, and just try to think of these traditional building elements in a different way. So, for instance, and really sort of focus on one particular aspect that might unlock future potential for future architects. So, for instance, in the chapter about the floor, we focus on the high-rise building, skyscraper, which actually post-pandemic has become much less fashionable. But that's the beauty of writing a book. It can sometimes time can move on where the book stays there. But I'm sure we'll probably build high buildings again, or we're still building high buildings. But basically that chapter focused on how we can create variety and difference within the floor plate, and not just make it a standard thing that is a slave to how many meters squared or square foot of floor space you can get your developer. And the section on the wall looked at things from the border wall built between Israel and Palestine to the separation between inside and outside in a building, so really trying to think of it in a more expansive and current way as well, and look at different aspects that affect these elements. Because, as you rightly say, there's absolutely no point in anyone trying to define exactly what a wall is or exactly what a floor is. These things were long built before they were able to be theorized. So it's really just, hopefully the readers will see when they buy the book, or if they've already read it, that it's an alternative take on each of these very traditional architectural elements.
Great. And so, You know, when you were on last time, I, of course, asked what you've been working on since the book came out. And so since we kind of went through that already, unless you have anything to add, a question I have is, so now that, you know, we've talked twice now, and so, of course, both of your books, and the last one being The Entering Architectural Practice, both definitely reach a wide range of audience, but there is a bit of an emphasis on, I guess we'll say, the student population, at least in my opinion. You can correct me if that's wrong.
No, I think that's correct.
And so the question I have is, you actually kind of alluded that you wrote this book for students, but you weren't even teaching at the time. So what has led you to write more for students versus maybe some others?
Yeah, I mean, I think partly, and this may be completely apocryphal and it may purely be hearsay, but I think students tend to read more architecture books than architects do. I think as an architect, you're just too wrapped up in what you're doing day to day to really reassess what it is that you're doing. And I think that early gestation period for a student of architecture is really important. So I suppose it was my way of trying to reach out to a slightly wider audience. And I think with anything that you do, whether it's learning a language, learning an instrument or anything like that, the earlier you do it, the more that it will stick. So I think it wasn't necessarily a conscious attempt to focus on a particular market. The publisher may have seen it a different way, but definitely when I was writing the book, it was purely just my own thoughts on paper. And I didn't really, when I wrote those initial sketches and ideas, I didn't really know or care who was actually writing it for. And then it was just thoughts that I felt I had to get on paper. And I think that was a really good thing about having a publisher like Tendon Hudson basically go through the work and try and refocus it in a more meaningful way. And I think it's naturally led it to be something that students would more typically pick up, because although there's maybe some esoteric you know, subjects discussed and maybe some alternative viewpoints, it still is very much geared at trying to figure out what architecture is. And I think that's really important as a student, because by the time you're an architect, the world has already beaten you about the head and kind of forced you to think a certain way. So I think the earlier you can get some alternative and more esoteric viewpoints, the better. And then I think it ties in quite nicely to the second book I wrote. So the first book, this book, The Architectural Concept Book, is about what architecture is. And my second book, Entering Architectural Practice, is really about how we practice architecture. And those two things, in my view, can't be separated. So I think, I'm not sure where the trilogy goes after that, but we'll see.
Well, it's only anecdotal evidence, but I know the first architecture book I read after grad school was the first book I did on this podcast like 2 years ago. So I think there's some truth to what you said.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank
you. We need to read more. We need to read more.
I absolutely agree. So I want to thank you for joining me again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And to everyone listening, the book is The Architecture Concept Book, as well as his other James's other book, Entering Architectural Practice. And for all the viewers, thank you for listening and have a great day.